Anne's game. I do not believe that men have the advantage when negotiating. When I talk to groups of men and women on this topic the world over, I stress to them that I believe that men and women are just as capable as each other when it comes to negotiation. We are all more than capable of being amazing negotiators. I make this assertion having trained and observed men and women all over the world, in different industries, at different levels of authority, negotiating in a great number of different scenarios. But let's not pretend for a moment that men and women are completely the same. Let's not pretend that women don't experience different stereotypes, expectations, and assumptions to those that men face. All of this can influence how men and women are perceived in terms of their ability to negotiate, and there is plenty of research out there that evidences how some of these assumptions and stereotypes have manifested over the years. Whether we like it or not, men and women are often viewed very differently as deal-makers. Is there any use in being aware of these stereotypes? My view is that knowledge is power. The more that we know about these possible stereotypes and differences, the more empowered we can be to challenge them and break them down. Of course, you might look at the list of stereotypes in this chapter and think that either, as a woman, you know you don't do these things, and therefore this isn't something for you to worry about, or, as a man, you are confident that you don't think this way about women, and that therefore this isn't something that you need to be concerned with. But the interesting thing about stereotypes isn't just whether you think that they apply to you. It's whether the decision makers or influencers around you subconsciously think that they apply to you. It's this subconscious assumption that could lead to projects being awarded to others in the business, promotion decisions being compromised, or client relationships being passed to others who they don't think will exhibit these weaknesses as negotiators. Similarly, if you're a guy listening to this and you are pretty confident that you don't fall into the trap of holding these stereotypes or of being influenced by them in your interactions with women, I would urge you to undertake a really rigorous assessment of your behaviours to see if this really is the case. Also, are the men around you guilty of perpetuating negative stereotypes? And if so, what are you going to commit to doing about it? This chapter is all about understanding some of the differences and some of the stereotypes that exist in relation to women as negotiators. In each case, I will explore the assumption, look at the research, and provide guidance on how to overcome it or how to deal with it constructively. Women are less likely to negotiate, and when they do, they are not ambitious enough. In 2003, US academics Linda Babcock and Sara Lasheva wrote Women Don't Ask. It was a groundbreaking book that looked at some of the reasons why our gender might influence the outcomes we achieve at the negotiation table. In particular, the book explored the numerous research studies which had concluded that women have a propensity to avoid negotiation or to underestimate their opportunities to do so. A study which looked at students entering the workplace and being offered their first job discovered that only 7% of women would negotiate their starting salary, compared to 57% of men. This resulted in a 7.6% average baseline difference, $4,000, between male and female starting salaries. Further studies, of which there are many, by the way, produced a worrying statistic that this kind of average baseline difference in salary can equate, over a career, to men earning around $1 million more than women. Research from 2003 found that when male and female students were recruited to play a board game with a researcher and were offered between $3 and $10 for doing so, male students were 9 times more likely than female students to push back at the end of the game when everyone was routinely offered only $3. In short, the male students were being offered the $3 and saying, "Hang on, you said between $3 and $10. I want $10. Whereas the women were simply saying, "Oh, $3. Great." Based on the research, it certainly does appear that women are less likely to negotiate than men. The research to back up this point is both compelling and plentiful. Of course, there are always going to be women out there who both enjoy and seek out opportunities to negotiate, but they don't seem to be the norm. This phenomenon should be looked at on 2 levels. 1. Why are women less likely to negotiate? 2. Why aren't they ambitious enough when they do negotiate? Why are women not negotiating? A well-entrenched view is that women who do ask or negotiate are often penalised by others and viewed negatively as being greedy, arrogant, and generally not that nice. Depressingly, there is also a stack of evidence to back up the idea that women who do put themselves out there and who do ask are judged negatively by their peers. And I don't just mean male peers. Research shows us that women penalise other women in this way too. What are we missing out on by not negotiating? This is the big one, isn't it? What is the implication of women avoiding negotiation? Well, unfortunately, on a personal level, it can manifest itself in women missing out on promotion, salary, bonuses, high-profile projects, and other opportunities they might have been able to access or benefit from. On a broader level, it could result in poorer performance and outcomes when negotiating with clients, customers, or suppliers. In short, there are likely to be implications from a financial, opportunity, and performance perspective. As I have already said earlier in this book, negotiation is an essential part of how things get done. If women are avoiding it completely, then it follows that they are at a huge disadvantage in terms of future success and security. Tip: just ask. What's the worst that will happen? What's the worst that will happen if you don't? You know what, though? Not all women avoid negotiation, and a great number of us regularly engage in negotiation and take our place at the table. So what do these women who do negotiate need to be concerned about? Evidence suggests that women who do get to the negotiation table tend not to be as ambitious with the proposals that they make. When compared with their male peers, women don't aim as high in terms of what they ask for. Women are more pessimistic about how much is available when they do negotiate, and so they typically ask for and get less, on average 30% less than men. Women report salary expectations of between 3 and 32% lower than male salary expectations for the same jobs. Men expect to earn 13% more than women during their first year of full-time work and 32% more at their career peaks. You will know already from having listened to the section in Chapter 2 on opening ambitiously that the extremity of our opening proposal is going to have a direct impact on where the negotiation is likely to finish. If women are routinely unambitious in what they ask for, it will have very negative implications for what they end up with. This could be in relation to salary, bonus, or any term in a contract negotiation. Pow and pay. In 2014, the interim CEO of social media company Reddit, Ellen Pow, hit headlines for banning salary negotiations at the company as a way of promoting equality. When asked why, Pow explained that because women were known to not negotiate as well as men for their salaries, she thought that removing salary negotiations would level the playing field. While some commentators commended her approach to ensuring gender equality, others, myself included, took the completely opposite view. I viewed Pow's actions as reinforcing a very negative stereotype that women cannot negotiate as effectively as men. It sets a dangerous precedent. So women can't negotiate their own salary. Probably best not to let them negotiate with customers or clients then. And while we're considering it, we should probably stop women from being managers too, as they won't be able to negotiate on behalf of or with their team members. Surely the best thing to do, if there is a perceived problem with women's ability to negotiate, is to educate both the women who need to negotiate as well as those awarding and negotiating salaries. To simply take negotiation away from women sends the wrong message and may worryingly encourage women to believe that they cannot negotiate as well as men. Confidence. We have discussed the fact that women fear being penalised by their peers or boss if they negotiate, so it follows that our reluctance to open with an extreme proposal or to test the water could also be driven by a fear of appearing unreasonable or greedy. But there may also be another reason as to why women aim far lower when approaching their negotiations. A question of confidence? In their book, The Confidence Code, Katty Kay and Claire Shipman explore the assertion that women are not as confident generally as their male peers. The book explores how societal conditioning and subsequent treatment can reinforce this difference and suggests ways for women to try to overcome this. In addition, the message from the authors of Women Don't Ask is that women routinely undervalue the assets or benefits that they personally bring to a situation. This might start to shed light on the broader issue of women generally undervaluing themselves. There is an old anecdote that if a man reads a job description and thinks he can do 30% of the required tasks, he will consider himself suitable, whereas a woman who is 80% qualified will focus on the 20% she can't do. Similarly, research tells us that men will take more credit than women on a project, even if both have contributed equally. In the world of negotiation, if women undervalue themselves and their contributions compared to men in similar positions or of similar qualification, this could well explain why so many women don't aim high enough. We just don't think that we are worth it. Tip: do your research, know your value and know your market. Then, when you make the ask, increase it. Add on 10% or 20%. Ask for an extra week on the deadline or for a higher percentage point on the grade. Aim high, because the guys are doing it. And besides, you never know for sure what someone might be willing to give you. Women are more likely to be lied to at the negotiation table. As we have already discussed, people lie when they negotiate. Not everyone, and not all the time, but people do. It was with great interest, therefore, that I read some research which suggested that women are more likely to be lied to at the negotiation table by both men and women. Linked to this, researchers have discovered that you are more likely to be lied to if you have feminine features. But on a serious note, if it is the case that women, or anyone with feminine features, are more likely to be lied to at the negotiation table, what should we do about it? Should women adopt the stance that no one can be trusted? Should employers assume that their female negotiators might be getting poorer outcomes because their counterparties have probably fed them inaccurate information throughout? My response is a simple one. It merely reinforces what we should already be doing as negotiators, and that is being aware throughout the negotiation process that people might be lying to you, withholding information or bending the truth. We should always research so thoroughly that we know our topic, market, or product inside out. We should have preempted what we think our counterparties' positions and offers might be. We should know any governing statutes, regulations, or industry best practices. In short, we should know our negotiations so well that a lie is more likely to expose itself. We can also take steps to observe our counterparty. You can start to read your counterparty, understand some of the hidden messages in the words they use, gauge their discomfort level, and look at the body language that might expose what is really going on. Every negotiator knows that you need to be prepared, and a little bit cynical. Be ready to test what they are telling you, question anything that feels too good to be true or too draconian, listen to what they say and how they are saying it, and always be ready to offer alternatives rather than anchoring to their potential lie. Effective questioning can also work to your advantage. Asking questions that force them to explain their proposition in detail, or asking questions that are cleverly designed to expose contradictions or differences, can put a negotiator who is bending the truth in a very tricky situation. Final point on this? It's not just women who are lied to. Men lie to men and women lie to men too. No one is immune, so don't get complacent. Everybody, male or female, needs to wake up to the fact that not everyone will share your values, and that includes whether or not someone might be willing to lie to you in order to get what they want. Women can't do the tough stuff. I'm sure you've heard this one before. Indeed, you may have heard it touted as a positive attribute that women bring to the world of business and commerce. I'm talking about the belief that women are naturally more collaborative than men. In Chapter 2, we discussed the fact that not all negotiations are the same. Some are more competitive in nature, and some are more collaborative. It would seem logical that some people have a preference for the tougher negotiations and others for the more collaborative interactions. The danger for women and men arises when the decision-makers and influencers around them start to assume that they can only be effective at one or the other because of their gender. I would certainly testify to the fact that I have met a great many women who thrive in the tougher, more direct and competitive negotiations, and a great many men who seek to build partnerships and create value through collaboration. It would be very foolish of someone to sit down opposite their counterparty and make a snap judgment on their potential negotiation style solely on gender. However, we should also not ignore the research. The tendency for women to be more collaborative in business, and in life more generally, is well documented by academics and observers from a range of backgrounds, specialisms and cultures. This is also true specifically in relation to negotiation. As I said earlier in this chapter, men and women are different. It's how we understand, manage and use these differences that will set us apart. I always think at this point it would be worth considering the idea of the fixed pie bias, which asks us to consider what proportion of the negotiations you do are inherently tough or competitive in nature, how many are win-lose transactions, how many involve people whom you will never see again and whose view of you, either personally or professionally, you don't care about at all. For most people, the answer is not that many. For most people, the majority of their negotiations won't be one-off, tough, win-lose scenarios. Their negotiations are more likely to be more complex, to involve a consideration of partnership or future interaction, and to involve numerous variables and potentially numerous parties, proposals, and interests. As someone who has trained thousands of people worldwide on effective negotiation behaviours, tools and strategies, it is certainly my view that the more collaborative negotiations are the ones that are actually more difficult to get right. The balancing of people and relationships alongside profit and commercial sustainability is a challenging one, and the notion of win-win can often be a struggle, especially if ego and a desire to win start to impact proceedings. My own experience does seem to bear witness to the stereotype that women are more inclined to be collaborative than men and tend to actively avoid doing the tough stuff. So, for the sake of argument, let's assume that we believe the research and embrace the stereotype. A truly collaborative mindset requires a heady blend of sophistication, maturity, professionalism, poise, creativity, curiosity, and commercial expertise. So, if women are naturally more collaborative, then that's fantastic, because it means that women are well primed to be strong all-rounders as negotiators. Why? Because even if women are naturally more collaborative than their male peers and try to avoid doing the tough stuff, it doesn't mean that they can't do the tough stuff. They can. The reality is that all people are naturally competitive. We have had to be to survive and thrive as a species. The will to win and to achieve our goals exists in all of us. It's just that many of us find doing the tough stuff uncomfortable. It makes us feel awkward. It rubs up against our core values and preferences. But we can do it. We need to learn to live with this discomfort. Get comfortable with it. Recognise that being tough, direct or competitive is often a means to an end. And remember, the other party is probably more than willing to be tough on you to ensure they walk away with what they need and leave you with a lesser outcome. Plus, you know what? Being tough doesn't mean you have to be rude. Being direct doesn't mean you have to be aggressive. You can maintain your professionalism and integrity while being competitive and ambitious. You are more than capable of doing the tough stuff. You just have to learn how to manage your reaction to it. Women really don't like to say no. As we have already explored, a negotiator is going to have to get used to rejection, both delivering it and being on the receiving end of it. If every negotiation we engaged in was just littered with constant yeses, then my assertion would be either that you haven't got anything like the best outcome in that negotiation, or this isn't really a negotiation if you have no differences in approach, policy or practice that require you to need to seek agreement or consensus. I don't believe that anyone likes to feel rejected, whether they're male or female. But women tend to struggle more, both with hearing the word no and saying it to others. Of course, in the world of negotiation where rejecting the requests of others is such an intrinsic part of the overall process, this could present some particular issues. The process of rejection is often in itself fraught with challenge. We are often conscious that the person we are rejecting may become angry, upset, or frustrated with our decision. As a result, we weigh this up and act accordingly, dependent on whether or not we need to preserve any kind of personal or professional relationship with them in the future. But even if we are going to engage with this individual on a longer-term basis, there will still be requests and proposals that they make, which for various reasons we will have to say no to. Studies tell us that women are generally more concerned with the perception of others. Women are more worried about not being liked and how they are viewed by the person they are interacting with. In the world of negotiation, this translates into a belief that women are likely to capitulate more quickly in a negotiation because they don't want to keep saying no to their counterparty for fear of how they might be perceived. The worry with this belief is when it starts to influence who is awarded the more difficult, challenging, or high-profile deals. If decision-makers start to believe that women are less effective at saying no, this could have a huge knock-on effect. Have you ever seen someone say no to something? Then, as an obvious result of their discomfort at having said no, they keep talking and talking until they have completely watered down or even cancelled out the original no. This is not uncommon, but it is something that women have to learn to deal with if we are going to overcome the stereotype and secure effective and robust deals in the future. How to say no. When I speak with audiences around the world, I give them two alternative tips to overcome their uncomfortable relationship with the word no at the negotiation table. Whichever works for you, run with it. 1. No is a complete sentence. 2. Try saying no differently. Women are better at negotiating for others. For a great many people, the bulk of negotiations they undertake will be on behalf of others. Think of sporting agents, lawyers or estate agents who negotiate on behalf of their clients, union representatives who negotiate on behalf of their members, managers who negotiate on behalf of their team, or parents who negotiate on behalf of their kids. However, there are other kinds of negotiation. In particular, the kind where we are representing ourselves and our own interests. This might be in relation to salary, job title, flexible working or personal terms and conditions, anything that matters to us personally. According to research, it is these kinds of negotiations where women have a real problem. In short, women are far more effective at negotiating for others than they are for themselves. This idea is very well entrenched and robustly researched. Numerous reasons have been put forward as to why women won't negotiate as hard for themselves as they would for the people around them, but they tend to boil down to two key issues, which are a fear of how they will be perceived and a chronic undervaluing of skills and worth. The first issue links back to a theme that appears to run throughout this chapter, which is that women are often socially penalised for asserting themselves and asking for what they want. The problem is heightened by the fact that women are often very aware of this and are conscious of the possible or perceived ramifications. The second links back to the notion mentioned earlier, that women tend to have lower levels of confidence than men. They more frequently downplay their achievements, underestimate the impact of their contributions, and undervalue themselves and their skills. As a result, they ask less frequently and ask for less. These two limiting issues combined might explain why women appear to achieve better outcomes for others than they do for themselves. When advocating for someone else, you can throw all of your energy and skills behind selling the achievements and value of that individual. It ceases to be a personal matter, and so the notion of being arrogant, greedy, or overly ambitious does not impair the negotiation. Once again, whether or not we believe this stereotype or belief to be true on a personal level, the volume of the research evidence means that we would be foolish to ignore it. I always give two pieces of advice to the women that I speak to. If you recognise that you might be selling yourself short at the negotiation table, I would encourage you to follow either of these two strategies, the first from Margaret Neal and the second from Lois Frankel. The first approach is to embrace it and use it. Professor Margaret Neal of Stanford University is a leading expert on the psychology of bargaining and on the impact of gender on negotiation. Neal is an expert on the topic of how women can become more effective negotiators and has also contributed to learning resources for women as part of the Lean In campaign, the movement set up by Sheryl Sandberg to encourage women to speak up and lean in the workplace. Neil's advice is to use the fact that we negotiate better for others to our advantage. She feels that if this is the case, we should use it to make sure we end up with better outcomes. I always refer to this advice from Professor Neil as her husband, horses and chickens advice. The thrust of the message is that if we recognise that we are better at negotiating for others before we next have to negotiate on a very personal issue, such as salary or flexible working, we should remind ourselves of all of the people who are depending on us to get a great result. So, Neil says that before she would go and negotiate anything with the dean of her faculty, she would remind herself of all those relying on her. It might sound something like this. Come on, Margaret. At home you've got a husband, 2 sons, 3 daughters, 2 grandkids, 2 dogs, a cat and 8 chickens, as well as a mortgage to pay. You'd better get a good result here. I know from experience that some women love Professor Neil's approach. As soon as they hear it, they embrace it fully, and a great many have contacted me at a later date saying how well it has worked for them. But I also know that some women find the advice slightly uncomfortable, as it appears to suggest that a woman's worth needs to be gauged by the people around her, rather than being based on her own contribution, skill set, or value. So as an alternative, I also give my female audiences some advice that was given to me by Dr. Lois Frankel, author of the groundbreaking 2004 book Nice Girls Don't Get the Corner Office. Right before I went to New York in 2015 to do a speaking tour on the topic Is Negotiation a Man's Game, I sent a tweet to Dr. Frankel asking for the one piece of advice she would give to women who want to improve as negotiators. Her reply was succinct. Of course, it had to be in 140 characters. But the gist was that as women, we need to recognise that we are worth it, and we should learn to view advocating for ourselves as both admirable and acceptable. Now, this will potentially be the more challenging of the two approaches. It will require confidence, practice, tackling your nerves, being expertly prepared, and knowing how to deal with anxiety, stress, and the impulse to back down too easily. But in my view, that's something that most negotiators should be learning how to do anyway, male or female. I always say to my audiences, explore which of these approaches works for you, then use it. If the outcome of adopting either of these strategies is that you end up with a more robust outcome for yourself, then my job here is done. Women don't like to be chameleons. The final stereotype or belief that I want to highlight is one that, again, I believe both men and women struggle with when they are negotiating. As I said in the Common Negotiation Mistakes chapter, we need to be able to flex and adapt our style as negotiators. This is because not all negotiations are the same. Each will require different strategies, tactics, and behaviours in order to get the optimum outcome. One of the overwhelming pieces of feedback I have received from both men and women across the globe is that women generally feel more uncomfortable about flexing and adapting their behavioural style at work than men do. Women report that they find it disingenuous and inauthentic, or they worry that it will be obvious to their counterparty that they are just acting and will therefore lose their professional credibility. Men just don't seem to have this level of concern with having to play tough when it suits them. Of course, one of the reasons for this could be the social penalty that women experience when they do have to behave in ways that might fall outside of the traditional female behavioural set. As stated previously, when women are seen to be tough, direct, or assertive, it can elicit a negative response from both men and women. To avoid eliciting this reaction, many women therefore avoid deviating from a more feminine way of behaving. Whatever the reason, we have heard from many women that they do not believe that changing their behavioural style will work in their favour. Once again, I believe that we must challenge this. To be able to adapt your behaviour and style in a professional and credible way is a key component of being an amazing negotiator. If you can't be tough on a difficult issue when the situation requires it, or can't build rapport and partnership when required, then you are essentially a one-trick pony. I believe that negotiators should be more than able to adapt their approach in a manner that is professional, credible, convincing, and authentic. Not only that, my view is actually that women have the distinct advantage in being able to be flexible in this way. Why? Because we have been doing it for generations. Women have always been required to play multiple roles. This has been especially true since women won the vote and entered the workplace. I will use myself as an example. Over the course of a week or a month, I will play a number of different roles. So, I know that the Natalie who had a few too many glasses of Rioja with her friends in a bar in Brighton the other week, and was slightly talkative and exuberant, is very different to the Natalie who was forced into getting up at 3:30 a.m. every day by her toddler, and who tried to reason with him that this was not a sensible time to have breakfast. And that Natalie is very different to the Natalie who led tough negotiations in France with a very direct trade union official. And that Natalie is again very different to the one who coached a concerned CEO on the phone about a forthcoming merger and the impact it would have on the emotional well-being of his staff. Each situation resulted in a very different version of Natalie, exhibiting different behaviours and approaches, but they were all still Natalie. I never stopped being Natalie for 1 minute. I have just got comfortable with the fact that life requires us to be flexible, to have multifaceted versions of ourselves that we use at different times. That's not disingenuous. That's not misleading. That's just a sensible approach to dealing with everything that life throws at us. Chapter 12. It's a cultural thing. Culture is the collective programming of the mind that distinguishes one category of people from another. Gert Hofstede. As business evolves, technology advances, and new markets open up, it is clear for all to see that we are living and working in a global economy. As a result, it is not uncommon for us to have to negotiate with people from different countries and continents. This might be negotiating with one of our colleagues from a regional office, or negotiating a supply deal with a company on the other side of the world. For most of us, at some point in our career, we will have to contend with negotiating across borders. My firm trains teams in large companies all over the world on how to negotiate effectively. We are regularly asked what impact culture can have on a negotiation. The short answer is that, of course, the culture can have a huge impact on the deals you do. But our advice is always not to become intimidated or too obsessed by it. As with everything in negotiation, awareness and knowledge is power. In this chapter, I outline some of the things you might want to consider before negotiating across cultures, followed by a list of the aspects you should always remember when negotiating across cultures. What you might want to consider. The following outlines just a few of the things you might want to consider when you are starting to think about negotiating across cultures. This list is by no means exhaustive, but I hope it can stimulate some thinking to help you when you negotiate. There are collective differences across cultures. In his definitive text, When Cultures Collide, Leading Across Cultures, Richard D. Lewis outlines the fact that the world's cultures are vast and diverse. However, he offers a classification to assist the global business executive with navigating some of the common differences and similarities between our numerous cultures. He splits world cultures into three main categories of cultural personality traits. Linear actives, those who plan, schedule, organise and do one thing at a time. Lewis suggests that Germans and Swiss fall into this group. Common traits, introverted, patient, quiet, private, punctual, job-oriented, sticks to plans, sticks to facts, dislikes losing face, separates the social from the professional. Multi-actives. People who are lively and like to do many things at once. They plan their priorities based on thrill or the importance attached to each task. He asserts that Italians, Latin Americans and Arabs fall into this group. Common traits are extroverted, impatient, inquisitive, talkative, not punctual, changes plans, people-oriented, seeks favours, expressive, interweaves the social and the professional. Reactives. Cultures that prioritise courtesy and respect, listening calmly and quietly and reacting carefully to each side's view or proposal. He asserts that the Chinese, Japanese and Finns are in this group. Common traits are introverted, patient, respectful, good listener, reactive, people-oriented, thoughtful, plans slowly, uses controlled body language, connects the social and the professional. Understanding some of the generalities that exist across cultures can help you to begin your planning and preparation. The Linear Multi-Reactive Model, LMR, developed by Lewis, is a great starting point for thinking about how best to communicate, provide information, present proposals, and plan ahead for the duration and style of the impending negotiation. For example, Lewis explores how different cultures best like to receive information, with those from multi-active cultures preferring to engage in exploratory dialogue, and those from linear-active cultures preferring to receive hard data. This might help you to work out a strategy as to how best to present your proposals to the other side, or how best to reason with them if they reject your request or point of view. Consider the social setting. You should be aware that different cultures view the negotiation process differently. Some cultures will view it as a straightforward and pragmatic exchange of information that sits firmly within their professional sphere, whereas others will view it as a social ceremony in which there are specific considerations in relation to participants, hospitality, and protocol. Some cultures view it as a more formal and more public process by which to ceremonially ratify a series of decisions already made behind closed doors, whereas others view the negotiation process as an opportunity to unpack and explore the possibilities that might be possible. Learn body language norms. Different cultures have varying interpretations of body language, such as facial expressions, physical contact, eye contact, hand gestures, and what we do with our feet. There are also differing norms in terms of personal space. Do your research to avoid any awkwardness. Language barriers exist within languages. This isn't referring to the fact that different countries speak different languages and therefore an interpreter may be required. It refers instead to the fact that even within languages, there can be varying nuances and interpretations that can have a huge impact. While English is often viewed as the international language of diplomacy and trade, it should be noted that words and phrases such as fair, reasonable, level playing field, and makes business sense will have different meanings across different cultures. Understanding decision making. In many ways, negotiation is simply the means and process of reaching a decision or series of decisions. How decisions are made can vary from culture to culture. There will be differences as to how long it will take to make a decision, who will be involved, whose opinion carries more weight, and how binding a final decision really is. Social taboos. Different taboos exist in every country in the world. In Lewis's book, he reveals the following. In Russia, it is taboo to stand with your hands in your pockets. In Indonesia, it is taboo for your head to be higher than that of a more senior person. In England, it is considered taboo to overly discuss your successes or strengths. In Malaysia, it is taboo to point with your index finger. While some of them might appear outdated or outlandish from your perspective, you would be wise to adhere to them where possible, or at least take the time to discover from those with more understanding of the culture whether they are taken seriously. This is because many taboos are deeply rooted in history, religion, or societal belief, and to ignore them can send a strong message of disrespect. Remember, the process of negotiation is universal. It is worth remembering that negotiation as both a concept and a process is pretty universal. Human beings have been negotiating with each other since the dawn of civilization. It acts as a social lubricant that allows relationships to grow, agreements to be made, goods to be traded, communities to function, and countries to collaborate. The key elements of the process of negotiation – trading, persuading, influencing, seeking an agreement, securing an outcome – are consistent in countries and cultures around the world. The point here is that the process of negotiation that you embark on with someone in a different continent to you is not going to be radically different from a negotiation with someone based down the street. So don't panic. You will still need to do your research, make some proposals, hear their proposals, experience rejection, and try to reach some kind of agreement. All of that stuff doesn't fundamentally change. It should be standard that before any negotiation, you have taken the time to explore anything that could well impact how the deal unfolds. This could include market conditions, past performance, the balance of power, financial implications, reputational issues, corporate aspiration and potentially culture. What might change, though, is some of the stuff around that process, and this is where knowledge is power. Do your research. Of course, having just said that negotiation is universal, the rituals and behaviours that different cultures bring to a negotiation can be quite different. While this doesn't impact the fundamental process of negotiation, it will almost certainly impact your experience of a negotiation. There are some pretty well-established and understood differences that exist in relation to how different cultures approach negotiation. This might be in relation to the hierarchy required not to offend your counterparty, the length of time taken to consider your proposals, the level of toughness adopted, the offence that might be taken at an extreme offer, whether they wish to get to know you or just get straight down to business, or whether or not women are welcomed at the negotiation table. We call these cultural nuances, and they might well impact your experience of deal-making. If you have identified that a difference in culture might impact your deal, then just as with any other influencing factor, you have a duty to research it thoroughly in order to mitigate its impact and ensure you are fully prepared. There are lots of places that you can gain information on cultural differences, including speaking to colleagues based in or with experience in that region, researching online, or reading books such as Richard D. Lewis's. But don't assume. Of course, while knowledge is power, it is also essential that we don't fall into the trap of assuming that cultural stereotypes are universally true. Some dealmakers will indeed adhere to cultural norms or fit common national stereotypes. However, for many others, they could not be further from the truth. My firm trains negotiators around the world, and I can testify that I have met many people who certainly don't match up to those stereotypes. I also know a great many British negotiators closer to home who are not at all governed by fairness. A clever negotiator should seek to understand what the cultural norms are so that they can prepare for them if and when they are presented with them. The danger is that we read the stereotype and then automatically assume that our counterparty will exhibit it or respond to it. Awareness, rather than assumption, has to be the key to effective preparation. This all boils down to the fact that people negotiate with people, and ultimately, people are all different. Preparing for cultural difference. It is worth remembering that stereotypes and social conventions exist for a reason. On a societal level, they act as points of reference for interacting with strangers, but we must learn to manage and utilise them correctly and not be led astray by lazy assumptions. It is essential that you research and understand how culture could result in the negotiation being conducted differently, or how the other party might behave because of where they come from. But it is just as important to remember that everyone is different. Treat each negotiation and each negotiator individually, and be prepared for anything. Part 5. Tools. Negotiation Tactics – Reference Guide. Earlier in the book, I said that knowledge is power when deal-making. The following reference guide is designed to help you identify some of the common tactics that are used in negotiations. Some of these tactics, such as timeouts, conveying disbelief and using silence, will stand you in good stead and may be a useful addition to your negotiation toolkit. However, I am not advocating that you should look to use all of these tactics, as many are fairly aggressive, intimidating, and potentially counterproductive. As we identified earlier in the book, sometimes people will deliberately try to intimidate you, trick you, and manipulate you in order to get a result that works in their favour. Throughout the book, we have looked at ways to combat this, particularly in Chapter 10. As well as following that advice, you can also refer to this guide to gain some insight into some of the tactics that people might use against you. Consider how each tactic might be used against you, or why you might consider using it. Ambush. Showing up at a negotiation as a large group and outnumbering the opposition can have a significant impact in terms of conveying power, as well as potentially intimidating your counterparty. How you then proceed to behave as a large group will dictate how this tactic will be received by the other side. Bullying. Using inappropriate, insulting or unpleasant behaviour such as shouting, screaming, swearing or gesturing to intimidate the other side. If you are on the receiving end of this, remember that there are ways to diffuse this behaviour, and uncovering the reasons why they are doing it could actually work in your favour. The decoy. By placing great emphasis on something that you don't actually want and which is unachievable for the other side to give, you place yourself in a potentially stronger position to get them to agree to the things that do really matter to you. This will require effective planning in order to execute it, as you will need to understand what each side could potentially concede on and to what degree. You might also have to carry out some preconditioning to sow the seed with your counterparty that the decoy variable matters to you. Appeal to their ego. Using phrases and questions such as, "Are you sure you have the authority to agree to this?" or "I'm not sure whether your firm is open to this kind of innovative approach," can serve to trigger the other side's ego. If they value hierarchy and power, they might go to greater lengths to show you that they are mandated to make a decision or that they can authorize a different approach, even if it hadn't originally been part of their plan to do so. It's up to you. Be cautious when your counterparty offers you the choice of two options in a challenging negotiation. An often used tactic to try to make you feel like you are in control is for your counterparty to offer you the freedom to choose between two options, but each option is as bad as the other, just dressed up differently. Always consider the impact of any concession you make. Seriously? Come on! By conveying disbelief at your counterparty's point of view or proposal, you might be able to embarrass them into making a further move or rethinking completely. Time out. Adjourning the negotiations to take stock, review progress, craft new proposals, or simply let each side reflect or calm down can be incredibly useful. Timeouts can vary in length and can result in renewed focus for all sides. A well-timed timeout can also prevent deadlock. Do be mindful of your counterparty using timeouts excessively to try to increase time pressure on you or to avoid talking about key or contentious issues. Could you just explain to me? By playing dumb and asking the right questions, you can assess your counterpart's honesty and how much information they might have access to. If you ask a question to which you already know the answer, you are able to assess their integrity. Too good to be true. The old saying, "If something is too good to be true, it probably is," should be remembered when at the negotiating table. If an offer seems to be too good to be true, actively look for hidden disadvantages or issues that might not be immediately obvious. I'll need to speak to... Telling your counterparty that you need to defer to a higher authority before coming to an agreement can be a great way to prevent yourself being backed into a corner and agreeing to something you don't really think you should. It can also help preserve or improve your relationship with the other side, as you can blame certain decisions on someone other than you, or seem like the hero when you persuade the higher authority to agree to something in your counterpart's favour. Let's get physical. Be aware that some counterparts will seek to unsettle you using physical means, such as invading your personal space, positioning chairs in such a way that you are isolated, or even doing things unexpectedly such as putting their feet up on the table. This is often done to throw you off guard or give the impression that they are more powerful than you. It's oh so quiet. When faced with a wall of silence, most of us will go to great lengths to fill it. A clever negotiator knows that sometimes saying nothing can encourage the other side to keep making concessions rather than sit out the silence. Be mindful of this happening to you and make sure you don't keep making concession after concession. If they keep saying nothing, ask them a question or state that you would be keen to hear their views. Can we take this off the record? A chance to explore options with your counterparty, air your concerns or share some insight, an off-the-record meeting can be a great tactic to keep your negotiation on track. Just ensure that it is truly off the record and agree some ground rules if you are discussing things that are particularly sensitive. You don't want your off-the-record discussions being used against you in a more formal setting. I wouldn't do this for everyone. Leading your counterparty to believe that you have gone to great lengths to facilitate something for them that is exceptional and above standard practice can lead them to feel indebted to you and more likely to agree to your requests. Good cop, bad cop. When one of the negotiating team plays the good guy and the other the bad guy, the bad guy is aggressive, dismissive, and rude, and then they are taken out of the equation for a while by the good guy. This is designed to make you feel indebted to the good guy so that you more readily agree to their suggestions. If you are on the receiving end of it, just remember to stick to your plan and remember that they are playing a game. Don't fall for it. If you are looking to use this tactic, ensure that your bad guy is credible and don't go over the top with this. Otherwise, you end up looking like a comedy villain and the tactic becomes transparent. Everyone else is doing it. Showing your counterparty evidence that everyone else in their industry is buying this product or doing it this way can create a sense of panic about being the odd ones out or missing out on best practice. Can you match your competitors? A common tactic is for one side to point out to the other that one of their competitors has offered a far better proposal. You are pushed to see if you can match it, and, out of fear of losing the deal, you do, even though the outcome becomes far less profitable. Be clear on your breakpoints, and don't agree to things that are damaging for you. Also, make sure you ask for evidence or detail of the competitor's proposal. That way you can point out why your proposal is different, better, more robust. It can also help you establish whether the proposal from your competitor even exists. Tick tock. Come on, I've got to go in 5 minutes. Do we have a deal? You have until the end of the day to make a decision. If I don't hear by Monday, I will be speaking to another provider. When your counterparty uses deadlines to try to force an agreement from you, make sure you find time to consider fully the implications. Try not to be rushed into anything. At Advantage Spring, we believe that anyone can learn to be a brilliant negotiator. Our approach to negotiation is to demystify it, to make it accessible and understandable for everyone. The Advantage Spring team works with clients around the world to provide interactive negotiation workshops and coaching and advisory services that boost confidence and capability and that directly result in enhanced commercial results. We have partnered with banks, law firms, manufacturers, retailers, technology firms, government departments, international development agencies, media organizations, and leading academic institutions. Our training is challenging, enjoyable, and memorable. And, most importantly, it works. Advantage Spring. We know negotiation. To find out more about Advantage Spring, visit www.advantagespring.com, email us at office@advantagespring.com. That was We Have a Deal by Natalie Reynolds, read by Susie Riddell.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.